Welcome to Women's Issues and Men's Issues. We're on the fourth session. Our primary goal is to talk about relationships. However, we will be completing the discussion on family. Ray?
Susan? Well, my mind is kind of wrapped around an output of words at the moment because I'm working on a newsletter that I put out through the Division of Service and Mission in America, the Mission Discovery Program, called Women Say, Men Say, which is based on the title of this particular book that I just heard you mention. And doing it reminds me that I have a couple of other resources that I would just present to you. This has been put out twice in the last 3 years, so it's very periodical. This will be the third issue, but I have the first two issues here, and if you'd just be interested in reading those, I'll put those on reserve. And then, ultimately, I'm thinking about this because I, a month and a half ago or so, worked up some content for an article which is going to be going out in the thing called Unified Mailing for the American Lutheran Church. Goes out to all the congregations throughout the whole country. And the particular focus of the one from the Mission Discovery Program this time is on men's issues, which I wrote and got it back. It really looks pretty. And so it's kind of, it's something that the content I did, and they laid it out, and it's really nice. So I can just put that out, and you could look at it. And,
you know,
next thing you have a t-shirt. Right. I never ever saw myself as being in print, although one of the goals that I put down for this year, since I was going to be kind of out of circulation in the ALC, was to do some writing, which has always scared the living daylights out of me. But I guess I'm doing some of that this time too.
So. To be on reserve.
Yeah, I'll put all of those on reserve. Can I read the story?
Yeah, I don't see.
This is a little eye-opener this morning, something to get your mind working, okay? A little riddle. Listen carefully, and if you get it right away, don't tell anybody else. One day I was walking down the street when I suddenly recognized a friend whom I had not seen in years walking in my direction with a little girl. We greeted each other warmly, and the friend said to me, "Well, I married since I last saw you, someone you have never met, and this is my daughter, Ellen." I replied, "You look just like your mother." How did I know that? Everybody get it?
Easy find, is it?
You look just like your mother. How did I know that?
I think it's some assumed assumptions.
Yeah, whatever.
That you're making.
Which is what?
That the friend was a woman.
That the friend.
Yeah, the friend is the mother. Make the assumption that we quickly get drawn into is because I meet a friend that it's an old male friend of mine. Right.
It's part of the communist plot.
That reminds me of that old one that doesn't look as well anymore about the father and son.
Mm-hmm. You mean this one right here?
Which said not to use it. You want it? Have you heard that one? Go ahead.
Should we do it?
Sure.
What you doing?
There was a boy and his father were driving down the street when suddenly a large truck careened around a corner and hit the car head on. The father, the car was crushed, and when their bodies were removed from the wreck, father was already dead. The son was badly injured and still was alive, but he was rushed to the hospital. that hasty preparations were made for immediate surgery. As the boy was brought into surgery, the surgeon saw him and said, "I can't operate. That's my son." How is that possible?
It's his mother. He's a surgeon.
We figured if we did one, we couldn't do both.
The first time I heard that, I just never got it.
It took a while, didn't it? Yes.
Now it caught me for a little bit, because I was already to think the truck driver was the woman. That was where it was.
There was another one that I found as I was reading a book on language and philosophy. And it's the old syllogism, one that I never, ever would have connected with, except that it was in this book. It's a syllogism about all men are equal, are mortal. All men are mortal. Okay, now that, we hear that and we think that means all of mankind, right? All of humankind. Then the next line is what? Remember it? Remember this?
Oh, yeah.
Socrates is a man.
Is a man.
All men are.
Therefore, Socrates is mortal. That's the that comes out of the logic, you know, the old logic class. Well, it never dawned on me. No, I mean, okay. So what would you do? All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. All men are mortal. Sophia is a man. Therefore, Sophia's mortal?
No, Sophia's a woman.
So then the syllogism doesn't work.
Maybe she's immortal.
It did 100 years ago.
Yeah, I know. And they were both in that thing, right? But it really didn't even make sense 100 years ago. It's just that we thought it did. I just was real surprised by my reaction to it.
Oh.
Sure, right,
assuming
Sophia is a
woman. Well,
Sophia is the truck driver.
Truck drivers are immortal.
All truck drivers are immortal. All survivors of truck drivers are immortal. Before we get into the article that I asked everybody to read, I would like to do a little bit of work with the mother. We did some stuff on Friday with fathers and the evolution of fathers changing their roles, and thought what I have here is from Wilson Chafe's book, Women's Reality. So some of you have read this, and some of you maybe have not. I don't know how many of you have read the book. Okay. There's the section in there on the mother-child bond, and what she's talking about is the whole business of men growing up being angry at women, and how that affects relationships and so forth. And she says that there. In the mother-child bond, there are four levels. The first, she said, is that, and she, in terms of mothers raising boy children, that a woman, her status is enhanced whenever she bears a child, but especially a male child. And it's in the small town that I just came from. It was real apparent that when a boy child was born, there was more celebration than when a girl child was born. They kept hoping that there would be another. In one family, all of the children except for one, all the grandchildren of this one man, were girls. And his son and his wife were expecting a child. And the hope was that his son would have a son, so that not only would that he carry on the name, but also so that this other boy grandchild would have somebody to play with. He was doing just fine with his girl cousins. I mean, there was no problem with Aaron, but there was this emphasis. And every time a boy was born, it was wonderful. So the mother mother is taught or is conditioned essentially to raise that child, if it's a boy, to experience himself as innately superior. And she educates him, as Ann Wilson Chafe says, for the full meaning of his birthright, because if he fails, she also has failed. So in a sense, the mother tends to see her success live through her son. On the other hand, with girl children, she says she raises them to be to know their place, that they are like her, that they are innately inferior, and again, you know, that whole thing about be a proper little girl, act like a lady. And what Ann Wilson Chafe says is that part of why that happens for little girls in the relationship with their mother is that the mother does that to help the child protect herself against the pain she knows will come if she steps out of her place. Then the second one, she says, is a class issue. That male infants, generally, she says, are dependent on an angry woman to raise them, because women can tend to look at their sons as members of the class that has oppressed her. And so she has this love-hate relationship with her son. She's real proud of him, but at the same time she knows that he's going to go out and he can do anything he wants, just simply because he's a male. And then one of the comments she makes is that as they grow up, they tend to do their best to stop women from expressing their anger. And I was trying to figure out how I would have maybe experienced that. And essentially how I experience it, and I just share that to see if this is true of other women. I know that there are the real obvious things like the battering and, you know, shut them up and that kind of thing. But for me, it's when I'm angry or expressing something and the person that I really care about says, and don't get so upset. You know, it's okay. You're going to be fine. You know, or it's just your mother. You know, the father saying, don't let it get to you. It's just your mom. She's having a bad day. Kind of discounting that sense of. We kind of learned some of that behavior. Well, with girls, in terms of the class issue, women tend to bond as members of the same class that we're all oppressed. And in that bond, there's a warmth, but there's also that the bond because we're all sufferers in this sense of oppression. But in order to bond, we must suffer. There's that element. If we don't suffer, that bond may not be there. So there's the struggle between mother and daughter. If the daughter, again, steps out of her place or begins to feel really strong and okay about herself and can move out of that sense of feeling innately inferior and goes out and does fine, the mother is sort of left behind. And so she does, in a sense, the reclaiming of the self for women might mean the death of a relationship between a mother and daughter. And that's real scary. The other thing is, the third level, she says, is ambition. Now the boy is taught to make it, to take advantage of all of his innate superiority and he's to do it for himself, but he's also to do it for his mother, which is a heavy load for men. And girls are also taught to do better than their mother, but also remember to get married and to have children. You know, go out and get a job, go out and, you know, educate yourself, be better than I am, but also remember that you must marry, you must have children, so that you can validate yourself, which is the fourth level. That essentially women are validated when they become mothers, validated as human beings. And they are especially validated by boy children. But even a girl is better than none. And what she also calls this level is the I hate your guts level. That mothers tend to react to their children, adult children, or as the children grow up, is basically not liking them because they're not, because the mother doesn't feel very good about herself. When, what she said in conclusion to that, she says that women fear their own power simply because if they ever experience themselves as whole and happy or free people, there's the risk of, when you act out of that freedom, the risk of being punished, the risk of being rejected, the risk of being put down by both men and other women, and especially that be our own mothers. And so there's, you know, we're kind of caught in that bond, that bind, if we buy into the model that she has expressed in the book, Women's Reality. And I think I see, you know, that this is pretty close, but most mothers are not consciously aware that this is what they're doing. Nor are those of us who would respond to our mothers conscious that that's what they've done to us. Or that not that they've done, but that the system has kind of created for them, and that there is no other way for them to do their job. Which leads me to the statement, the collective statement on the family, when he writes about, when he says, yet many men, this is on page 63, yet many men believe quite strongly that they are oppressed by women. There is a common belief that men are somehow trapped in the family, that marriage means giving up freedom of bachelorhood and being tied down. Despite the benefits we receive from having wives, we often resent the women we live with and their demands on us. The material basis for this idea lies in the realities of the battle of the sexes. And I think that he's kind of touched this area. You know, I don't know how else to, the boys, if you've I taught school in junior high. I don't know if, did you teach junior high? Either of you did? Yeah, but not in.
I worked with junior high
guys. One of the things that I experienced in the eighth grade, primarily, was that boys tended to not like women teachers. I mean, they had, you know, they'd kind of grown up, you know, with women teachers all the time. But there was this point at which, all of a sudden, the women teachers had no authority at all. I mean, I'm not going to listen to you. I'll go talk to this other. I'll talk to the coach. I'll talk to my dad. I'll talk to, you know, but I don't want to have anything to do with you right now. That changed again as they got older. But there's that struggle of kind of growing out of the mother-child bond into hopefully a father-child bond or the male world. And in a sense, that's a generalization because I didn't experience that with all of the boys, but they pretty much did have that sense of, boy, I can't wait till they get to be sophomores or whatever, just because it's such a hard time. It's a real hard age for them to be. So.
How do people respond to this? Is this touch a part of your experience, or is it?
I remember the week before our wedding, how many men came up to me and said, you have 1 week to get out of it, or two more days of freedom, aren't your last chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I got so tired. I remember how tiring that got.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the joke of our culture.
Yeah. It's kind of like the stag party, you know, the last night out with the boys, because you've...
Do you think that's
Once you kind of get back into that relationship with a woman, that's where you get stuck.
I don't think there's anything comparable to that for the woman getting here.
There is nowadays.
Nowadays, yeah.
What is that?
Steak parties?
Oh, right, yeah, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know what you meant.
Oh, yes, the shower.
But that is, that's...
No,
I think even there are equivalents to steak parties nowadays in the last 10 years. And also the jokes are to the women as well now, which I don't think they were 10 years ago.
But the shower was the alternative in traditional ways, the alternative. But not, you know, because it was, that's where the woman gets validated, so therefore everybody celebrates with the woman and everybody commiserates with the man.
Yeah. So statistically, men are, you know, more satisfied in married relationships. They live longer, they have, you know, they are bound to get married sooner if they're divorced or widowed or something like that. Marriage is a good deal for men.
But again, it's that love-hate thing. I was sharing with Ray yesterday that one of the young couples that I married in Sudan also lived upstairs in my house. They were renting from me after this. And she, all, you know, it's just like, they were very young, like very young, 18, 20. She was 18, he was 20. And she wasn't pregnant, so it wasn't a question of having to be married, but wanting to be married. And it was like he just flipped to the other side after this marriage. She would come, we'd talk about it. She said, you know, he used to be my best friend. And they went together all through high school. They've been going together since ninth grade. And they were really good friends. They just had a great time. Got married, and he was staying out with the guys. You know, after work, he'd go to the bar, just like all the rest of the men. Not all the rest, but there was that sort of sense of, there was a group.
All truck drivers are no good.
but there were, in that particular community, a lot of the men on their way home from work stopped at the municipal liquor store on their way home before dinner. And, you know, he was going fishing, he was going, and they used to fish together, they used to go hunting together. They did all of these things, the two of them did those things together before they were married. And within a month of their wedding, he was doing those with the man. Alone, not with her. And didn't really include her or didn't even want her to come along. She was supposed to stay home and clean the house and fix the meals and take care of him. And she was willing to do that, but she missed his friendship.
You know, when we talked about this the other day, I feel like I've done more work in terms of my relationship with my father since I've gotten away from home and tried to sort out who I am in relation to him, and much less in relationship to my mother. But what I was thinking was that, you know, when you're talking about this kind of what happens, I don't want to say this. Well, in the mother-child bond, it seems, if I want to analyze my own experience, in my mother-child bond, I've experienced a wonderful thing in relationship to my mother, kind of before I came to male consciousness. She and I were in this kind of nurturing, some sort of caretaking relationship. There may have been some things going wrong with it, as you point out, like, you know, she's going to make sure, she's validating me in a sense as a person. And then I sort of go through this stage where I have to reject that in order to take on my own male identity and really realize my own innate superiority, to get away from her, who's innately inferior in some sense. And when you're talking about that, it's just interesting because I know in a sense that I don't want to do that I need that kind of connection to the woman. And it strikes me that maybe when we go into marriage, we're looking for that again, and it's so wonderful to find it that you kind of give yourself to it, and then you get married, and then you push it away, kind of like you pushed mom away earlier on too. I don't know. I just hit those two parallels of that sort of wanting to be included in that kind of bond, but somehow your identity gets swallowed up in it or something. You have to distinguish yourself. Because I recognize that phenomenon myself, too. Other people. Does that make sense to people that in some way?
What is that out of? It's out of the Women Say, Men Say. Did you all read this? Dan read it. Besides being communist. Because it has a quote from Frederick Engels.
You know, when I read it, though, it did. It felt like my first comment to you after when we got together was it feels like a very political statement. There's something very political about it. And it's kind of dangerous to mess with that kind of view of things. And even this kind of stuff is, it's like, why do we want to look at things in this way? It's kind of socialist is the word that comes from using words like superiority, supremacy,
class.
It's an analysis, a political analysis of some sort.
Is a whole book like this?
It's pretty political in some ways. Yeah, the book is pretty political.
Well, I mean, in terms of its, I guess when I read it, I sensed a lot of anger. Mm-hmm. And then from that standpoint, I suppose if it was written to express anger, then it did
its job.
It did well. Mm-hmm. If it was written to communicate sort of awareness of a, let's say, written to a man to say, hey, this is the way it is, and if you didn't think about it before, it's an eye-opener, I don't know, I think it could have been written another way. To do that job better, one might not see the expression of the anger, but rather react in a fashion that you wouldn't accept it in a way.
So it rubbed a part of you that
I just
wanted to confront it back or something.
Yeah.
Can you confront it now? I mean, what makes you angry about the anger, not angry but upset about the anger?
I suppose the attitude. In other words, if in a marriage relationship things are not shared, the one-sided acts with the relationship, which they point out here, becomes very distasteful, and I don't know what sort of conclusions but they do shit work, cleaning up, changing diapers, etc. Most of the emotional nurturing. In other words, if you're to conclude from that, is changing diapers and cleaning up shit work, or is it become shit work because it's not shared? Mm-hmm. Mm. So then. No, if you don't, I mean, I don't think that sort of work should be described as shit work. That it sort of throws it, this is not, you know, it's like an evil necessity of raising a child, changing diapers, and having to clean up after them. As opposed to, a different attitude that this is something that should be embraced with some. You know, there's inherent goodness in this kind of work, and it isn't really shit work. But if it's dumped on somebody that just almost hates to do it, well, then I can obviously see how it can become that. Mm-hmm. But that's just one thing.
Well, I like your point about it's not maybe the nature of the roles or the particular tasks that people are doing, is the relationship they have around those tasks. And if they're mutually agreed upon, or if one is forced upon another. I mean, for a man, having to go out and work and bring home the money, not being with his children, whatever, that can also be shit work. You know, if you get locked into that particular thing. And I know a lot of men who say, I'd like to get out of it. They are powerless to do it, it seems like. But again, it's a matter of changing the system in some ways, or the communication.
go ahead. I'll just try to remember the stuff.
Kind of didn't include for me is just that whole statement of his that the family is an oppressive institution. I keep thinking about that also has a lot to do with how people relate with him. First of all, I have never considered the family an oppressive institution, although I can see many of these things that happen in the roles. But I think, for instance, you can't say it's an oppressive institution. You can only say that for some people it's an oppressive institution. And it goes a little bit along with his. But you, my mother, who has, as far as her life is in the family, has been through the era where it was considered the right role for the man to have the final word and so on. But if both people are happy and satisfied in those roles, and I think we're kind of trying to say no one really is, but I'm not so sure that's right. I don't think my mother would have ever considered the family an oppressive institution, even though today, playing out the same role that she played out, many women would find that oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I truly don't think she would have ever thought of that. It was an accepted role, but one that she was also happy in. And I think there's a little bit of danger today in making... I'm not sure that there aren't still some people today that would be happy in those roles, but are made to feel that there's something wrong with feeling all right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you're saying that, Carolyn. Otherwise, you'd be scared to go back and marry that man.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, except that I don't...
Depending on your relationship.
Yeah. Well, if all families are like this article says, all, that's pretty general. That's what I would agree on.
What I was thinking about as I was reading the article, and I wanted to mention too, is that if it's true that boys are raised, and I think in part boys are raised to believe that they can go out and do anything they want, and they can, you know, all they have to do is work hard and, you know, put out, and they'll be fine, except that the experience is not true.
But
I think you also almost have to, would you almost have to say fine?
Well, yeah, up to a point, although in black families, too, the boys are given, in some ways, a lot more power.
Hispanic.
Yeah, oh yeah. That whole thing, still, it's the male. But what you discover more in people of color is that they discover even more, and where there's more anger, I think, than anything, within men in relationship to women, quite often in other cultures, is simply that they leave that relationship. They've been trained, they've been raised to think they're really neat people, and then they go out and get a job, and it's awful, you know. And it's he talks about the alienation in the workplace, in the marketplace, and certainly from my experience in working with blue collar people on the Iron Range, that is their experience. I mean, they have no power. They have no authority. They have nothing. So they come home and try to work that out. I mean, they're angry with their families. Their parents are primarily their mothers, probably, because that was the first influence, for telling them that they could do it. The women come out better because they never believed they could do it in the first place, so therefore they're okay. They'll just stay home and do things that make them happy. But the men can't handle the fact that the women are coming out of this probably better, simply because their expectations aren't as high. So I don't know if that if that's helpful in terms of understanding what he's talking about in relationship to the anger and frustration in the family. Again, we're getting back to the male who can't. I mean, who's...
That's going to be even more so as the economy is tighter.
It just strikes me that it's so dangerous to tamper with the concept of the family. You know, and yet when I think back about my own experience, I somehow imagine that the family is kind of the haven from all the competition in the world. As a man, particularly, it's some place that I can go to retreat to, and my brood will be around me and everything will be fine, and there's that kind of feeling. It's in some sense kind of an ideal place where everybody's happy and things work out right. And I know that's not true, because if you enter your own, well, I'm thinking of it as an adult now, you encounter things that require some sort of, well, what's going on here? And so I sometimes wonder what it would be like if I would have known this kind of stuff. And it feels horrible and ishy in some ways, but and now even to think back about my own family, you know, I mean, I have kind of a sense that I came from an ideal family. It worked out pretty well, you know. I'm doing okay, and my mom and dad are still together, and they do all sorts of things together and whatnot. And so why do I stir it? I have a tendency to stir up the waters.
In the family?
Yeah, I have a tendency to stir up the waters, particularly when I look at my own unhappiness, places where I feel like I've got blind spots or whatever, and open those up and relate them to the family. Then I start understanding some of this stuff, or it seems to fit into it. And I don't know what I'm trying to say exactly, except that it seems like we're working on more than whether mom is happy and dad is happy, and the system's kind of working in that sense. I keep trying to put it in the larger picture, that in the societal picture or our national picture, you know, something's not working out in our government, in our society. How do we relate that to the way the family works, if that really is kind of the training ground for us all, or where we really do receive our identity? And then it seems like these things are needful to do. Something like that.
Just read in 4 Inses. In ancient Greek Roman society, the hierarchical family was so important, because that's where a child learned that society is like, if you would tamper mm-hmm. with that, it was considered a political mm-hmm. act of treason, you know, to anyway call into question the hierarchical family, because it was a political act mm-hmm. of, that would be the way you would undermine the whole system of the hierarchy of the Roman Empire being set by the gods. No, I think there's some of that. If you'll notice how, especially right-wing groups, are so touchy about anything ever being said about the family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a very
sacred kind of
sacred.
Isn't a spouse pretty much implicit in a patriarchy?
Spouse,
in contrast to being single, mm-hmm. unattached.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, excluded from that patriarchy because you're not part of the system.
Yeah. Right. Didn't do it right. All pattern, whether it male or female.
Where is forgiveness in Christian love and Christ? Example in intolerance. I mean, we can be angry, but sin not. I think we have to go beyond finding these reasons to be angry or feeling put upon. How do we build better relations? How do we as Christians show that there can be love and there can be forgiveness and there can be wholeness? Because if we don't have that message, then
this may be a very general answer, but one of the ways that I believe that we move into that space of genuine love and forgiveness and understanding is to go through the place of what's not working and term that I used last night, the men's group, which is not a popular term, is to make friends with what's not right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With your pain, make friends with the darkness.
Make friends with what's missing or what's wrong is the way I...
Dan mentioned that, you know, some of the right-wing pushes to canonize the family and the whole idea that, and I think that goes into our national life too, that somehow if we just say everything's okay and have this optimistic outlook on everything and just say, cover up, you know, all of these feelings and say there's nothing wrong, go back to the old ways, to the good old-fashioned values and so forth, then everything will be okay. But the fact is that the process of forgiveness does mean identifying your anger and your hurt and the woundedness and being able to go from there into healing. It means admitting that there is something wrong. And then being able to go on and forgive.
Someone in the group last night made a comment that felt really good to me in terms of like, it seems like 95% of what is good. And I thought about that. I thought, what would it be to believe that? For me, that ties into notions of about we are blessed. There is abundance. Love does reign. It seems like not confronting or dealing with the 5% that isn't often makes it feel like 95% is bad and 5% is good. It's just a feeling that I often have, is that things are so hopeless that when you start talking about this. But I don't know, it's like,
not
if you don't acknowledge it and deal with the 5% that isn't right, it's kind of like the thorn. I got this sign up in my house and never even thought of, but it's like it's not the mountain, climbing a mountain that gets you down. It's the grain of sand in your shoe that
you focus on, and therefore it seems the 95%.
Right. Right.
I think the article ends in a sense, in a hopeful sense. You know, in terms of saying, he says, we do not recommend that individuals, particularly male readers, abandon their families. You know, I mean, he's not saying that. He says, changes in our families and living situations will have to be part of the revolutionary struggle that is being fought in many levels. We want the transformation of society, not merely any of the individual options presently offered. Single men not living in families must help to care for children. Women up until now have been forced to bear the major concern for raising children. And that's, we still get back to the shit work. But, and most of the emotional nurturing. Men and the families have not generally concerned themselves with such day-to-day chores. Rather, their role has been to maintain control and authoritarian. Fathers should break out of this role and begin helping to take all-around care of children. And I think when he says that, it goes back to there's a statement just prior to that, in which he says, in the family, most men are as alienated from love by their power as they are in the market, alienated from work by their powerlessness. And I really think that it is an issue of learning how power and love are, you know, how having power over and being in a position of power and having the authority does not make it necessarily true that the people that you have power over are going to love you. They may obey you, you know, they may have a sense of, well, you know, just out of fear or whatever the reasons are, you know, respect, out of a Christian faith of, you know, this is what I've been taught to obey, so I will. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to lie. And I think for men, it's equally as devastating to realize, you know, how hard it was for my father to come to grips with his children who thought that he never loved them. And who also was living in a space of not ever believing that his children loved him. It took us as adults to confront that, to get at that anger of his absence, and to talk about all of those things, what his feelings were, what our feelings were, to come to a point where we really did believe that we loved each other. But he had to say it, and I had to say it before, you know, and in some ways the relationship changed then. Not all, not all. He's still trying to maintain his power over, but he doesn't. You know, it's a lot, he's a lot more comfortable than not always having to do that. So I think, I agree, we need to work, we have to get in touch with what is it that prevents us from being, living out of that Christian faith, and that sometimes is simply lack of communication and getting at the issues.
I had an encounter with my dad 2 summers ago, this particular one that I thought of now because of this question, and I realized that there was something. I'd done some thinking and work just about my relationship with him, and I remembered some times in the past where he had hit me. And that was real surprising to me to say, yes, that actually did happen, and I remember that happening. And I mean, I just basically kind of shoved it out of my consciousness. And they weren't real strongly abusive things like when I bled or anything like that, but they felt abusive in a sense because he was an adult. I was a very small child. And you know, he took some life out of me doing that, and it made me afraid of him. I discovered many things about that. I felt very hurt. We'd never resolved it, never talked about it. I had some anger about it, and I was scared of him. It was one thing that made me scared of him. So I went home and asked him to have lunch, and knew that that's what I wanted to do. We'd never had lunch together by ourselves before, but I knew I wanted to talk to him about that and just say something to him about it. And I think he must have known something was up, because before as we were driving to lunch, he started talking about his concept of history or something, and how, well, his concept of history, and that, and we somehow got around to this, I believe you just kind of let bygones be bygones. The past is past, and, you know, you just start afresh in the now. And that was the moment that I knew I was going to go ahead and talk to him, because I said, well, I don't believe that's true, totally. I believe that who we are together now is also a part of who we've been in the past. And that if that feels very present, then that needs to be dealt with. And so we eventually, in the lunch, I told him about these things and asked him some things. And it was really scary to do that. And he didn't know how to respond and kind of tried to deflect it. And it felt really hard. But where it ended was, I don't know, it was kind of one of those cosmic moments where all you see is the other person's face. And I felt just an incredible sense of love and resolution with him, just another level of that love and forgiveness. It was very present. I wanted him to say, could you forgive me for doing that? He wouldn't say that, but just talking about it, the forgiveness became real. And it was just an incident that I had that I thought in relation to what he said.
There's always a danger that we have to keep reminding ourselves that no matter how many changes it's possible to bring about, that's not going to be utopia either.
No.
There's your body's going to be forgiveness to work out in relationships.
That's right. He and I had done one like that 3 years earlier, and it didn't last very long.
One of the
and that also, yeah. I think we're going to always have to be aware that there is maleness and there is female, and perhaps there's no way that there can ever not be some,
I guess for me, the hope is that I know there will always be, and conflict is a part of just being in a relationship, or just being with, you know, unless you live by yourself and totally not in touch with people, but is the mutuality in the conflict. To recognize that my anger or my frustration or my needs are as valid as Ray's, and that we have to it's harder to work through those, you know, as we even work on how we're going to do this course. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a struggle trying to figure out who's going to do the talking. If he leads all the time, does that do to the image people have of me? If I do it, what does it do to the image people have of him? And I sometimes wonder why we even try to be in a relationship. Which kind of leads to...
Maybe we should talk about
relationships. That's why I thought that was a good transition, don't you think?
Very, that's good.
But approach to letting go of what other people image of you.
But it seems like what we've been doing is we have been talking about relationship. Yeah. We've been talking about vis-a-vis our parents and our formation as men and women. I wonder if it might be closer to home if we talked about it in terms of our relationships with each other. We have to talk about it really specifically in this group, or with men or women who are of the same age. Hmm. Which is, I guess, what we want to do now. Right?
Men, women who are the same age.
Well, whatever. Just our relation. What we're talking about is parent-child relationships. Now we're talking about adult-adult relationships.
Peer.
And how do those work? And where?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's seems like you're talking. That's an image question. Who am I as a person in a relationship? How do I let go of what I want to be, so I can be what I am, or something.
On a trip to Central America, our trip to Central America was about the things we did, sessions on marriage and family. Which I was glad, because so the focus wasn't completely on all of the political stuff. And people that, especially so many marriages break up among poor people. And what is so helpful to them is when most of the marriages break up over inflation, not enough money to buy food for the family, which causes anger, tension. And the freeing thing for those people is when they find out that it's the system that's breaking up their marriage and not their own personal failure. Because they will tend to look inward and say, I have failed. And then once they have that consciousness of the system, then they can realize they're not each other's enemies, but they're victims in a way together.
Victims to me.
Yeah, and therefore they can be together to struggle. I just wonder if there's a connection in it. Is there something freeing for us to see how we are oppressed by ideas in our society, and that we're not personal failures when relationships break up or when marriages are in tension? Or
if you've never been married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it isn't, it isn't a personal threat to me.
Just in reading and Embracing the Exile last night, he was talking about why people enter into therapy, and that it's usually because they think there's something wrong with them, and that society is thought to be good and reliable and natural in a way, and that's not questioned at all, that the problem might be there.
But there is also, I mean, I don't want to let go totally of the sense of being made to feel by another person that I'm a failure. It may be because of the system. It may be because of this, of society. But the reality is I can be hurt and I can be oppressed by another individual. Simply because I'm gay or because I'm single or because I'm a woman or because I'm black or because, you know, Jewish. Whatever, that because of a system and because of roles that we're kind of conditioned to live out, other people can hurt me. Other people can make me feel like I'm crazy. And I'm going to believe that, and I'm going to live out of that fear, and I'm going to live out of that sense of failure. Whether I am or not, I can't just discount the fact that that's what happened. And that we need to get at that, I think, somehow. In terms of how we see relationships, how we see men and women in relationships, how we understand ourselves as sexual beings and as spiritual persons. Our spirituality is, which is a done on Friday, but you know, how we see ourselves in relationship to ourselves, in relationship to other people, in relationship to God. And basically those three should be the same. And if one of them is messed up, the others get messed up too.
I don't know if this is a word of hope or not, but it's just been interesting for me. You mentioned about the single. It's always been society's interpretation of there's something wrong with single and marriage is the better and so on. I used to get very disgusted that, you know, you always have matchmakers and so on. And even people who looked at their marriage and you wouldn't have wanted it at all because it didn't seem ideal at all. Yet they were always trying to get you for
life.
Right. It's a thing which I never quite understood.
Yeah.
But the thing that has been interesting to me when I think about it now, even though we still, I think, are very much in that era, perhaps it is a sign of some real change. There has been no one, there have been lots of supportive people, but in all my friends, acquaintances, and relatives, there has been no one that has made me feel that now that I'm going to get married, that's great because that's going to be better just for sake to be married at Teresa. And that's kind of just come to me as a real nice revelation that no one, neither my family, I'm sure my family are not thinking, I mean, just the fact that I'm being married, they're happy about it, but not that that's good because now she's not going to be single anymore. I haven't been given that either, which makes me think that there is some change of consciousness, that it's not suddenly I will have made it because I have gotten married and then it's
interesting.
And being pleased about that.
Yeah, right. Isn't it fine to, you know,
because it means I was accepted for being
what to you
single.
Are, yeah.
That wasn't, as I said, it used to irritate me a lot that people didn't seem to, but now when it comes right down to it, I haven't been able to feel that nearly as much as I did.
Maybe I'll do this thing about relationships between men and women in terms of power. Can I do that?
Sure.
I'm a little hesitant to do it now because, again, it seems like it's raising the problem area. but it's just one way of viewing how relationships kind of get set up when we gravitate to the stereotypes. And so I'll write it down, and then we can just kind of. Mm-hmm. we talked about the mother-child bond and the whole idea. What we're talking about basically is the concept of man having power over women, or the need for men to have power over women, or the need for men to dominate, which is the male domination thing, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about patriarchy, which is a way that we describe the system that we live in, the hierarchical nature of it. Just simple things like man being the head of the household, the name gets passed on through the male, it's the heirs are the sons, things like that. Shows up all over the place. The most common theories about why men need to have power over women is something that we're talking about, is that as children, men feel dominated by women. Women do the child care. They're there all the time, sort of taking care of them, telling them what to do, how to be, and so forth. Not only as mothers, but as teachers earlier on in their life. You talked about the boys eventually starting this rebellious thing against their teachers, sort of respect for their authority and whatnot, and some of that has to do with the establishing of male identity process. So the theory is the mother domination theory, and or female domination theory or something like that. I'm getting this out of the book called The Men Say, Women Say. It's an article called Men's Power with Women, Other Men and Society, a Men's Movement Analysis. It's on page 255. What they want to suggest is two other, maybe more productive or useful ways of looking at men's need to have power over women in sort of a psychological or role or behavior thing. The first one has to do with what they call expressive power. And the second one has to do with masculinity validating. That last thing you put down there, Susan, about the validation. And they're suggesting that these are two areas of life where men perceive that women have more power than they do. Women are able to express themselves emotionally. You know, we talk about women being the carriers of emotion, men being the opposite of that. And then the other one has to do with women, I mean, it's sort of a reverse power, but women have a way of making men feel good about who they are. I don't know how else to say that exactly right now. I don't want to say it anymore, but I think for me there's some truth in that. You know, if a woman can affirm me, it's... And yet, of course, I'm trying to get away from that at the same time. So there's those two. Let's see. And of course, that results in a lot of imbalance in relationships. First of all, then I feel like I don't have much expressive power. I have to turn to a woman for that. I don't really feel very good about myself in relation to that. The relationship between the masculine and the feminine is all out of balance because she's got that, I've got this, I'm trying to get that from her and whatnot. And the same thing with masculinity validating. Then the other interesting thing that I found was when he talks about men's power in relation to other men, which is kind of where the real power exchange is happening in some sense. If you look at the world as a place where men are trying to work out their power with each other. And the things that they talk about there is how women fit in to men working out their own power with each other. And the four things that he says are symbols of success, mediators, a refuge. I already mentioned that one. It's like from competition.
And the last one is an underclass. Say briefly something about each one. But there's a certain way that men have of measuring themselves off against each other in terms of who has the most beautiful wife, or if you are married or if you're not married, that in some ways a woman is a symbol of your masculinity and what your wife is like. The mediators have to do with, he uses a nice phrase in here, something like talking about the civilizing effects that women have on men, that men are together, when they're together by themselves, they act a certain way. However, if there are women or a woman present, their behavior changes. And I like the terms, the civilizing effect that women's presence has on men. The third one has to do, I think, more with something like the man out there battling it out in the world. And when you come to, it's almost like coming to mother again. You can come home and just sort of let it down. I've got a song that I wrote called Mother Don't Mother Me. And the first verse is 3:15 and the school bells ring. We were free for another day. In the mad parade from the second grade, I made my homeward way. Up the stairs, I jump them in pairs. The door slammed like a bomb. Once inside, I dropped my pride and simply yelled for mom. I mean, it's kind of like you can let go of it all, and women act as this kind of refuge. But imagine the heavy burden that is. That's what dads come home and kick off their shoes. And I'm not saying that just happens in the family either, but it happens in male-female relationships. And the last one is the concept of women kind of being the underclass in relationship to men's relationship to men, to other men, or with other men. It's, the concept is kind of like, well, even if you're not making it, like your 0-18 record, you know, in basketball, even if you really are kind of at the bottom in this competitive hierarchical scale with men, women are always lower. So there's no way, in some ways, you can sink as low as women, and that protects you from, you can always fall back on that, that it protects you from feeling like a real loser. And so men are invested in keeping women, in some sense, in an inferior position.
That's where I just thought single person fill the role in making married people also feel, even though they're married as lousy, they always thought a single person was still lower.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you're blowing it, Carolyn.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
I think we had a very important role to play.
I don't know if we can do anything with that one.
No, no, that's priceless.
Everybody has somebody to hold in.
That's right. Below a single person?
Children.
Dogs.
Children are always at the end. Yeah. You know, that really interests me. We talk about a dog is man's best friend, and yet when you walk here, we say something derogatory, we categorize somebody as
a dog.
A dog. I never understood that.
Or a bitch.
That must be a low
bitch.
Yeah. Speaking of male female, though, and this is off the subject a bit, but still, you talked about your junior high.
Yeah.
Students. What is it in my experience on the high school level? Was as guidance counselor where you got in on all the squabbles and so on.
Uh-huh.
There was nothing worse than two females who got at each other, even physically. I mean, they would physically abuse each other, but they couldn't let go of it. Two fellas could, you know, shake hands, or I don't know if they shook hands, but anyway, they could feel all right about it. These women, they would come back to it weeks and weeks and behind the back, talking about each other, getting at each other. Now, is that their acting out against each other, the anger they feel towards the male, or is that just my experience in this community?
No, that's real common. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else want to respond to that?
I mean, those things tend to be more what we consider a masculine trait.
Mm-hmm.
This real anger and fighting and abusive language and so on. And yet, I've not heard anything like what some of these girls would come up with in senior high. course, I admit, it wasn't the girls that were brought up to be young ladies. It was, you know, kind of the other element of the society in this community that were a little bit more...
On the other side of the tracks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But where the women probably did bond it over the men. Domestic relationships,
anyway,
at least verbally.
So awful.
Yeah, where the men felt powerless in their workplace and felt jealous of the women in their home place. Yeah, and didn't know how to respond. I think
and the
my
women didn't hold on to their anger at home.
That's
probably.
Right.
They probably laid it out.
Yeah. I suspect, I mean, I can't, I'm only speaking out of experiences. Part of it is that women don't learn how to compete fairly. We don't learn how to compete. They're learning more now because they're opening up. I mean, I'm talking about athletics. When we were growing up, we got to play, but we weren't given the same kind of team. I wasn't, and our generation wasn't given that same kind of learning how to play in a team type of thing. As the girls are now, because they're opening up that kind of experience for them. But the competition, I mean, girls are really, at that age, are extremely competitive in relating to men. And we can't trust each other, and we can't be best friends anymore because, you know, we've got to take care of ourselves, and that means I've got to find somebody for me. So, and we also don't know how to fight. I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a generalization. Anybody else want to respond to that?
That's a hard thing for women. They always get us to see each other as enemies in relation to men. Mm-hmm. And now the system, I don't know if you say the system or something, has taught women to almost hate each other in relation to men.
Yeah, I think it says that somewhat in this article about keeping them separate.
Keeping women separate?
Like
when they get in the home,
isolates
them from each other.
Isolation sort of thing.
Which in a broader scale is always the technique of the oppressor.
Yeah.
To be oppressed is to fight them. To divide them against each other.
But see, there's a concept with men, too. I mean, I feel competitive with other men for the attention of a woman.
Mm-hmm. Is it different, though? Is it different?
I don't know. I was just thinking not of the difference so much as the similarity that when you live in a system, in a particular system, that where that competition, then we, it's like three's a triangle, you know. There's always somebody that's getting left out, which is unfortunate.
Carolyn, do you remember the nature of the arguments?
When I
think about it, often it was about
boyfriends,
you know, somebody to somebody else about what this girl had done in connection with or hadn't done, or who was, or, yeah, very often I had to deal with. Okay. We need to stop.
No.
Well, folks, the Ray and Judy.
I guess the only other thing,
the thing that's
on my mind now is that I know I feel very strange in some ways talking about this stuff in a theoretical sense,
mm-hmm.
because I know that what it does for me, it stirs up a lot of feelings, and I sense that present in some in the group. I want to just say that. Say that I get left kind of hanging with that.
And it would be my hope, too, that when we're done, when we complete, that we will also come to a point of some resolution.